This is the TV Booth Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the TV Booth Podcast. I'm Rob Francis. Thank you so much for downloading. My guest today is a broadcaster who has tried more than 400 different sports in his role as a presenter on BBC Breakfast, but he'll be best remembered for a rather amusing incident at the Commonwealth Games. Just a couple of days ago, I was very lucky to be able to sit down and have a chat with presenter Mike Bushell. Mike, it's a pleasure to be talking to you today on the TV Booth Podcast.
Great to see you, Rob.
Thank you. I should just point out for the listeners that we're actually face-to-face.
Yes, indeed.
The first face-to-face podcast. We are here at the White Hart in Overton. Lovely pub in Hampshire.
It is gorgeous.
And I can't think of any better place to chat with you, actually, to be fair.
Okay,
so let's start at the beginning.
Yeah.
How did it all begin for you? What inspired you to want to work in television?
Well, it's bizarre that I know there's been this programme on recently called Up, the Up series, 63 Up, which I've followed in my life, actually. It's very true when I look at it, give you the man at seven, and I'll, sorry, show you the child at seven, I'll give you the man. Because for me, that works to a T, not that I realised. So, grew up in a Stevenage flat, council flat, and then parents, both teachers, they moved to a Hertfordshire village called Ashwell. Loved that there. One of the first things I did, one of the first things I wanted as a kid was a duplicator. Now, for those too young to remember those, these were things where you could get a typewriter sheet, put it in the duplicator, it would knock off several copies. You turn the handle, it was about the size of a chair, really. It was quite big. And you could knock out several copies and you didn't have to type it out again and again. So you'd type out your stuff. And so I did a little village newspaper for my mates. It had a circulation of 8. It was called the Daily Owl. It cost a penny. And I used to do sort of articles, competitions, the latest news from around the village. It wasn't very long. Pictures, cartoons used to cut out from other magazines. I don't know if it's copyright, but it's
87.
And I used to go on my bike and distribute it. Probably monthly, I think it was. It was called the Daily Owl. But then I kept giving away Christmas presents as prizes. So I remember it all stopped because, two reasons it stopped. One reason, I kept giving away all my Christmas presents as prizes. People would come and knock on the door. My mum would say, well, what are you doing giving that away? I'm just giving it to you for Christmas. Oh, he's won it in the Daily Owl. And then I organised a Nits a Knockout for the whole village. 100 people turned up. I put posters everywhere, but I didn't realise we were going away to Barnsley for the weekend.
Oh, dear.
So it was never properly organised, and a lot of people got a bit upset about that. So after that, I realised my place. I was only a small child. And then I got quite shy being a teenager, so I did lighting on productions, but never wanted to be in a play. I had dreams of being a farmer, a dairy farmer. Don't quite know why, or a zookeeper. I had a love of animals. But then when I was about 15, there was this teacher at school who persuaded me to be in a play because it was about a little mouse of a man called Willie Mossop in Hobson's Choice. And I went in that, and then through that got into the National Youth Theatre. So that was a big break, just by chance, by this teacher persuading. I thought, no, I'm too shy to go in this. But that was great for confidence. I advise anyone who can be in a production just to give it a go at school or whatever, because that was life-changing. And then did a degree in drama and theatre. I thought I could be an actor, but I wasn't really good enough. So I had various jobs working down the sewers, working in a shop. I was a Roman centurion on the streets of Winchester, £5 an evening I used to get for that. Jump out on tourists. except one time I jumped out on these guys have been teasing me every night, actually. They were sat in the pub garden. They see me standing there every night to do my lines in front of the tourists wearing my Roman costume and a sword. One evening they let all their dogs off the lead.
And
their
Their
dogs came sniffing and I jumped out with a sword and the dogs went mad.
Oh dear.
But I was quite scared of dogs actually, so I ran up the high street towards what was then Woolworths and flagged down a police car saying that I was doing this tour but I was being hounded by these dogs. So this policewoman gave me a funny look. Anyway, so eventually I did a drama degree but I thought being a theatre company was too in debt. So then I thought, well, I'll get a job on a local newspaper. Definitely advise that. So I went for the Hampshire Chronicle, and I was actually told by the Steve Robinson, who interviewed me, very nice guy, at the Hampshire Chronicle, that the only other applicant that was of any note was a lady who'd sent her pictures of herself topless in.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I got lucky on that. I was fully clothed and got the job.
Excellent.
For some reason. So, we were up and away working for the Hampshire Chronicle, posted out the Eastleigh Weekly News. Started doing my indentures, as they say, you know, you're training. They send you away to college for 10 weeks to learn law, shorthand. So I went to Highbury, Portsmouth for that. But after the 10 weeks, rather than carry on with my 2.5 years indentures, if you like, NCTJ, I think they called the course, over 2.5 years. We formed a band there, a very bad band called Don't Push the River. And so we gave up our jobs and went touring around Europe.
Oh, right.
So, which is a bit of a risk when you've got a job on a newspaper. But unfortunately, the third day in, all the stuff got nicked out of the van in Amsterdam.
Oh, dear.
So we ended up busking. But we kept going in our van, Ned the dustbin. And we got all the way to Sarlat in France, into Spain. And then in Sarlat in France, the van had completely broken down. So we ended up just playing at his restaurant and washing up. But that was great, a few months. Came back eventually and got a job on the Derby Telegraph, the Derby Evening Telegraph, which wasn't my favourite paper to work on at the time because it was very tabloid, and I've been used to the sort of sleepy journalism. Not sleepy journalism, very good journalism, but the Winchester Chronicle, the Hampshire Chronicle.
Absolutely.
The Derby Telegraph's a bit of a shock. So that, I then moved from there to the Windsor Observer, Windsor and Slough Observer, great paper in Windsor, launching a new publication as well, the Maidenhead Advertiser, great experience, great bunch of people. But then, out of the blue, because of a press trip I'd been on when I was at the Hampshire Chronicle many years ago with a guy called Henry Elf, who still lives in Long Parish, he invited me for an interview for Radio Solent. So there I was, got a job. They could see potential, apparently.
Yeah.
And so I got a job, the first job at the BBC in 1990, it was, February 1990, posted out to the Isle of Wight to be the Isle of Wight correspondent, which was a wonderful, varied patch.
Excellent.
Full of strange stories. But that was a great place to learn the trade as a radio TV reporter, because you're the only person there. And there were so many quirky stories there. I used to have drinks at a pub with a shire horse in Cowes, and with a fox at the Ventnor Spyglass Inn. There was a fox that used to sit on the bar stool eating pork scratchings and drinking a pint of speckled hen. Seriously.
Fantastic. So you've moved on to radio now.
Yes.
How did you get into television?
That was the lucky thing about being on the Isle of Wight, because I was the face of the BBC on the Isle of Wight, so you were the officer for the office staff. So if anybody came in with a story, you'd greet them, bring them into the office, make them a cup of tea, say, what's your story? So you were the face of the BBC on the Isle of Wight. Most of the time, that would then become a radio story, which I'd do all myself, record on a Ewer tape recorder, and then edit myself with razor blades in the little back room where they had two reel-to-reel machines, and you'd edit like that. And that would be sort of maybe 2 or 3 times a week. And then occasionally, if the story is big enough, for example, once when prairie dogs were tunnelling under the Isle of Wight, and they were a risk to farmland and farmers, and they were going to be gassed by the council, that became a big TV story. So I worked with a cameraman who was over there called Brian Bradbury, and he was the cameraman, and we used to film it together, and then I'd go across to Southampton to edit it. And those were the first little steps into TV. So once every 2 weeks, maybe I'd get to do a TV piece for South Today.
Yep.
But that was a good experience, and that went on for a few years until eventually they moved me on to the Thames Valley patch up in Reading, which was a very big patch and probably more important in terms of the crime stories that were coming out that I'd report on, but didn't quite have that sort of quirky sense that the Isle of Wight had.
Yeah.
But I suppose it gave me a better experience. And then eventually, after years of reporting, you are allowed to do a bit of news reading, breakfast bulletins on South Today, and then a few in the evening, and then occasionally, even at lunchtime, you start doing live broadcasts out and about, and so you move from radio to TV.
Yeah.
And learn how to work with pictures. They send you on courses.
Yeah.
And then that started, and then eventually specialised in sport and entertainment, doing what I think called What's On. Chance to be a bit more imaginative, a bit more creative, use the acting person that was still latent in me. And that enabled me eventually to then move up to the news channel, BBC News 24, and breakfast eventually.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about BBC News 24. Were you there from the beginning, or were you there?
Yes, I was. I remember the first day it went on air, I was a sports reporter. I had to go and interview Lawrence Dallaglio.
All right.
But I didn't take a box.
Ah.
And so it did look ridiculous. The first interview I did on the BBC News channel was an interview with Lawrence Dallaglio, and it looked crazy because my arm was right up in the air.
Oh dear.
Still under his nose. but yes, Mary Rhodes was the presenter, and it was 1997 when the news channel,
yeah.
The first faces on, and then presented there for a while. Then I came back to Southampton for a little bit to do a history series just while the news channel was getting going. But then in 2001, I went back full time to London, commuting up from Hampshire to work for BBC News 24, and then eventually BBC Breakfast, which were in the same building and the same office.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not now, but
that's right.
Because it's all changed.
Yeah.
So, what would you say you're most proud of, career-wise?
Well,
moment?
I think it really has been helping people that aren't sporty get into sport. And there's been so many numerous examples, because that's what it was. In 2006, the editor of Saturday Morning said, look, we're losing audience. For some reason, people they're going to make the cups of tea or going to the toilet when the sport comes on. What can we do? I said, well, I remember the days at South Today when we used to try and do features every, do the main sport, the results, the goals, the wickets, the tries, but then at the end do something that embraces everyone, maybe a sport that people do for fun or fitness, whatever it may be. And that at the time there weren't that many examples around, but I remember I was walking through a forest in Bracknell in Berkshire, and there was all these husky dogs coming, pulling people on chariots.
Yeah.
And it was the British Sled Dog Racing Championship. I didn't even realise it was out there. I went into the forest and found all these people with their lorries and their camper vans with jacuzzis for the dogs and cushions for the dogs. And this was their sport. I thought, well, let's do a piece on that. So we did a little report on that for a Saturday morning, and then started each week. People would suggest what they do at weekends, and it could be anything. Some of the bizarre history sports around shin kicking. And I thought, well, look, if there's a sport out there... And at the time, people were saying they didn't do sport because they felt they were embarrassed or rubbish. Because I actually was rubbish at sport myself at school. I was left on the wing.
Same
or left yeah, well, on the boundary. And I used to get fed up with it. But I thought, if there's a sport we can just do for fun, because sport should be about play initially.
Absolutely.
Just have fun with your mates, have a laugh, make each other laugh.
Yeah.
Whether it's tiddlywinks or badminton, whatever it may be. And then if you're any good, you can progress. But most importantly, it's got to be about playing, having fun with mates. But I realised in 2006, a lot of people weren't playing it because they didn't want to get embarrassed. They didn't want to be shown up. It was rubbish. And so this piece started. And then throughout the years, I kept having letters from people saying how they'd tried a sport that they'd seen on the TV. There's one called Horse Trek, and it was literally sitting on a horse and going for a ride as part of an organised group. And this lady said she'd never done the activity. Now she was doing that. Now she was competing for Great Britain about a year later, a lady called Sue. And then bizarrely, there was the, there's two stories. First of all, there was, I know it sounds bizarre, but I went to cover the Worm Charming World Championships in Cheshire. And this is where you've got, it was invented by a policeman who brought it across from America where it's professional. They use it to get bait out of the ground. They have these worm grunting, it's called, in American festivals. But the Worm Charming's in Cheshire every year. It started in 1980 by this police, ex-policeman, did it. It's a charity thing to raise money for his village. Great idea. You've got a square metre earth, and you've got half an hour to get as many worms out of the ground as you can on your patch, but you can't use liquid. It gets banned.
Right.
So I went along to Cheshire, to Wisterson. It was bizarre. There were people from Mexico with rain simulators that made the sound of rain. There were people on space hoppers. There were people playing musical instruments, tap dancing, singing, all sorts of methods. But the favourite method was twanging, where you stick a pitchfork in the ground and you vibrate it very vigorously. And you create a vibration. You make that noise as well. And these people that did it up there had massive muscles, upper body. They'd been training for months. Anyway, so I went along, and I was told the record was set by a Cheshire farmer called Tom Shufflebottom in about 1981, 1980. But then, after I did the piece, I'm not saying it was because of the piece, this little girl called Sophie Smith went along with her dad in 2009. She was 11, and she wasn't sporty. She didn't do so well at school. She wasn't particularly inspired by anything. She could play the recorder, so she went along with her dad, and she played green sleeves on the recorder, and they got 563 worms out of the ground.
Blimey!
And suddenly, you know, because of that, her confidence soared. She excelled at school, she excelled at other sports. She suddenly developed in all sorts of ways.
Brilliant.
And she was on the national news, well, in the newspapers here, on the Guardian, the Times, on the front page, just a little column. She was on national TV and radio in America the day Michael Jackson died, so it wasn't a quiet news day.
No.
But they were fascinated by this story about British quirkiness. Like, you've got the bog snorkeling in Wales, the worm charming. So that was one of the proud moments, that she'd had her life transformed because of this bizarre sport of worm charming. I know it sounds ridiculous. So many other examples then. The town of Llanort in Wales, in Wales, this town was in depression in the late 70s, early 80s. They came up with the man versus horse marathon. Then the bog snorkeling. They said, what have we got? We've got the bog. Let's use the bog. And they came up with this idea. You snorkel up the bog. You can't use your hands. You just use flippers and mask.
Yeah.
And they get 6 million a year now from the World Bog Snorkeling Championships and the World Alternative Games there. And there was a lady who went to that called Julie Galvin from Ireland, and she was suicidal. She was working out to top herself the next day. This is a few years ago now, and she saw something on the Guinness World Record programme on TV about the Bog Snorkeling World Championships, and it made her laugh. And then she saw something we'd done on bog snorkeling, made her laugh. And so she went to get swimming lessons the next day. She won't mind me saying she's a larger than life lady in many ways, but she couldn't really swim, so she had private swimming lessons. She learned how to swim. A few years later, she was the Ireland bog snorkeling world champion. She then went to Wales and won the women's championship and the world championship. bog snorkeling. Through that, she also got into wife carrying, which is an event held in Finland, and she became the heaviest wife ever to win the World Wife Carrying Championship. I know this sounds ridiculous, but
yeah,
she's written articles, books, she's been all over the world, she's become a celebrity.
Brilliant.
Her confidence, she's, you know, laughs all the time now. Everywhere she goes, she's recognised, and she's got so much self-confidence. That's what it is, self-belief, self-confidence. So she's probably my sporting icon, my favourite sporting moment. Someone like that's been so inspired.
Yeah.
And had their life transformed by seemingly silly, daft sport. Not that they're any good at sport necessarily, but they have their life transformed by the confidence it gives them.
We have got to talk about this, because a lot of people have been asking about this. The infamous moment in Australia last year.
Yeah.
Where you took a tumble.
Yes.
Into a swimming pool.
So let me set the scene. It's a life-changing moment, really, because every morning during the Commonwealth Games, I was so lucky because we were doing the sport on breakfast live from the beach. So what would happen, you'd go live at 6 o'clock in the morning, British time, which would be 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Australian time. By then, a lot of the events of that day had happened, so you'd have medal winners. So I think it's called Producing Talent, this group over there from Team GB and Team England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, would bring any medal winners or gold medal winners to the beach to be interviewed. So they'd do Radio 5 live, they'd do Hazel Irvine, BBC Sport, and they'd do breakfast. We'd all wait our turn. So you'd do the sport live, and then at some point, oh, we can grab Tom Daly, who's just won gold in the diving. Here we are, Tom, hello, on the beach. Beautiful setting of the sea, lapping at our feet, on the sand. That was our studio. On the Tuesday, I think it was, the 11th of April, we had a message at 6:25. In the morning British time, 3:25 in the afternoon Australian time, that the swimmers were stuck in traffic. We had six medal winners, five golds and one silver winner from Team England, all coming to be interviewed. So I remember their names, I remember what they'd achieved, but they weren't going to get to the beach. So they said, can you get to the swimming pool? Run up that road. So me and the cameraman called Rashid, we picked up his tripod and his camera and his live link, and we pelted it full pace up this road. It was now 28 minutes past six British time in the morning, past three in the afternoon Australian time. We walked into the swimming pool, and there were, on one side, there were holidaymakers just at their hotel. There's a hotel pool. There was a camera team of about four or five from BBC Sport with Hazel Irvine, because they were doing the recorded interview for the main BBC One programme. And I was told in a whisper by one of the sport producers to sit around the other side of the pool and get ready, because after Hazel had finished, we could do them live on breakfast. Now, all I saw was there was one main pool where all the holidaymakers were sat around, and Hazel Irvine had all the swimmers sat around this little tiny kids' pool, I thought, all of their feet in the water. They all had different microphones because they've got bigger budget, I guess, and so they all had different, their individual mics, stick mics. So I was on the other side of the pool, I've got my shorts on, thought, right, I can step into the water and interview them one by one, because I only had one mic, you see. And so I did the rest of the bulletin, and during the rest of the bulletin I was moving closer and closer to where the swimmers were, and I was talking about the table tennis star from Wales, and Hazel still hadn't moved. So I went, Hazel, when I was reading, just tapped her on the shoulder and gestured to her to finish, and she was very polite, she said, of course. So she got up just as I was coming to the end of reading about table tennis and saying, right, now we've got a very special moment here. We've got five swimmers sat by me in the pool. And I turned to them and I thought, well, I'll go along the line and interview them one by one with my one microphone. And they were just on the edge of the children's pool, I thought. So I stepped down saying I have to be careful because of the mic pack. And I remember their names. I remember us being done so well that I remember their names. Yes. Yes, I got it. I got it, all their names. But then, as I went to ask Sarah Vasey the first question, that's when I took a step to my right and didn't see the deep bit of the pool. And then went, wait, in slow motion, down into the deep bit, trying to keep the microphone up and trying to pretend that it hadn't happened. So I sprang to my feet and apologised profusely, while everyone else around me just fell to the floor laughing. The swimmers sat there, but they were laughing. So I then had to position myself between Sarah Vasey's legs. It was very, sort of quite a tight space, which was quite embarrassing, but she was just laughing. I got through the first question, she got through her first answer, and then kaboom, the microphone pack went, wet. So they went to the weather, and then they came back when we had managed to borrow a plugged microphone that we could then go along. We actually then did the interview, but it was obviously by then other things were dominating. Mm. And apparently the editor back in Salford, who was editing that morning's programme, was first livid. What has just happened? Oh my God, what's happened? Until a guy called James O'Hara outside pointed out, had she seen the social media reaction already within minutes? Within minutes, it had exploded. It was like going up all the time. Suddenly there were people on the phone from New Zealand, from China, from Uruguay, all over the world wanting to talk about it. Greg James rang up from Radio 1, had to go on his show that evening as well. It just went potty, but yeah, in a good way. I think because the swimmers took it in a good way.
Oh, yeah.
And they laughed.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about social media. Do you think social media has changed the way you do things?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. More than 100%, really. It's now almost taken over as the main platform, I suppose, because first of all, the way that the audience react, it used to be on emails, and you have to log on, go to emails to read audience comments if they didn't like something, if they like something. Now, as soon as it's on social media, they can react.
Yeah.
You get lots more stick, but you get a lot more positive comments. People can say whatever they want, it's all out there, it's public. It's a great way of engaging with the audience and sharing things. You can go live now. And so whatever I do now for TV, you have to do a social media version.
Yeah.
In fact, for this coming weekend, Friday and Saturday, outside the normal breakfast job, I'm going down to Bolesworth Horse Show, International Horse Show in Cheshire, to cover the equestrian. There's no real story for breakfast as such, but no. I'll be doing live stuff, tweets, social media, Instagram, Facebook, as much as I can.
Excellent.
And that's the role for going there. Mm. And so that's become now more...
Yeah.
I think more... and the Saturday morning pieces now, they... As much emphasis is really put on the social media version, which is done with text and
yeah,
a minute shortened potted version of it, where people have to get all the contributors as well to speak down the lens to camera rather than being interviewed. It's their story, if you like.
Yeah.
So social media versions have become as important, if not more important now. Mm. As well, a way of connecting with young audience and a way of them hopefully drawing people back to watch the main programme.
Absolutely. So what would you say is your all-time favourite sporting moment?
Oh, goodness me. Well, I remember, gosh. I mean, everyone's got their own team. I'm for some bizarre reason a Leeds fan. Glory Hunter for the Saints. Yeah, I know, Glory Hunter
for the
Saints. I always liked Saints as well, but yeah, it was mainly Leeds when I was 560. I was told at school, living in Hertfordshire.
Should point out, I'm a Southampton supporter.
Yeah,
I love
Saints as well.
That's why he mentioned Saints.
My family are Saints, so I do like Saints. And funny enough, when I was living in Yorkshire, and Leeds were way down in the second division, I followed Saints as my top division team. They've always been my top division team.
Yeah.
But obviously, you looked at times. I remember, I was old enough to remember when they won the title in 92. So on a personal, you've got your personal favourites, haven't you? I obviously remember England at World Cups, I mean, the highs of the win over Cameroon, and so many highs. England beating Holland 4-1 in the European Championships in 96, and last summer as well. Football's probably given my greatest highs, even though it's been watching on the whole on the telly.
Yeah.
I suppose being live in an event, wow, there's been so many, lesser known sports I've been to cover. I mean, I've been to it, it's funny because you go to Olympics, but you don't necessarily go and watch the sport. You're in a studio or you're in an office processing the information from your live point. I think taking part in running the London Marathon and finishing the London Marathon, that's got to be one of the best, not just sporting moments of anyone's life, but of any part of life, because the crowd, the atmosphere, the bonding, the camaraderie that you get, the energy you get from everybody around, and the support, just to finish. And that goes for any race, whether it's 6K, 10K, a London Marathon or whatever. I think that sense of achievement is wonderful. I mean, an all-time sporting moment is such a hard one, because do you go personal or do you go...
Professional. Yeah.
Professional, yeah. Mm. Professional. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I mean, professional. Wow. I think Andy Murray. I wasn't there. Yeah, Andy Murray winning Wimbledon was a highlight. I'd been covering it in the morning, but I had to get back to Andover because my daughter was doing a Beavers and Scouts parade. But I remember taking her into this pub in Andover, seeing him do it, but only about five people watching it. Mm. Because there was a football match on at the same time.
Yeah.
I can't remember what they were watching. There was something else on.
Probably would have been. No, it wouldn't be football. No, because no football season finished in May.
Yeah,
so.
I don't know what it was. But anyway, there was something else distracting them. But I turned to my daughter and said, do you realise the significance of this? Andy Murray winning Wimbledon. That was a hairs down the back of the neck moment, even
absolutely,
though I wasn't actually there.
Absolutely.
But I've seen some amazing matches there. but not finals, because you get to cover it in the morning, but then you leave by about 10.
Yeah.
Because you're only there to do the previews. But that was an incredible moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great moment.
Yeah.
And I hope his career will continue.
Oh, I'm sure.
Despite the injury, I hope he'll be back.
I think he'll be back in some form, even if it's doubles.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, a couple of weeks ago, a big event happened in your life.
Yes.
You married.
Yes.
Your lovely new wife, Emily.
Yes, indeed.
And you may have seen the photos on social media of him and his new wife on a tandem bicycle. There is a story.
There's a great story, isn't
there? There is a fantastic story involving a member of staff at this pub where we are, the White Hart in Overton. I'm going
to let
you tell the story, Mike.
Yes, I really didn't know what to expect. So my university mates from Winchester, from King Alfred's actually, we weren't good enough to go to university, I have to point that out. It was King Alfred's College at the time. It is now Winchester University, but at the time it was King Alfred's College back in the 80s. Great mates who now various live in London probably, and one lives in Bath. They clubbed together very kindly. A big surprise at the end of the at the start of the party in the evening, they just came out with this present tandem, which they put together up at Oakley Hall. And of course we had to get on it straight away. We rode around the gravel at Oakley Hall. It became a bit of a sporting event because lots of other people never go. But actually, fair play to Emily, she had a bride's dress on still.
Oh, blimey.
And her mother, Angela Bond, from Overton, ran along behind holding the bridal dress up. So then for the rest of the evening, during the party, a couple of other people had a go. They're quite challenging. You've never been on a tandem. You can do it, but you do need to get into sync.
Yeah, you have to.
And so a few people took it for spins, and then it got put to a side when it got dark and people were dancing away. And then being the host, I hadn't had much to drink all day because you don't eat your own wedding, do you? So I was keen for the party to go on after one. And so I was sat chatting to a few people actually from another party, and Simon, the great landlord for this wonderful pub, the White Hart.
The assistant manager of this pub.
Assistant manager, yeah. Yep. Sorry, yeah. Yes. Nick and Simon.
Nick and Simon, of course. Double
act here. Yep. Assistant manager, I mean, yes, we all had a few, and it was about 3 a.m, and Emily and I, we'd had enough. We decided time to go to bed. And so Simon carried on having a tipple with friend Gemma and her friend. And I think Simon, I do remember Simon saying to me, "Oh, I don't know how to get back." I said, "Well," he said, "I might borrow your tandem." There's no way he'd get on tandem on his own. He'd ride those dark lanes all the way to Oakley from here. Sorry, Overton from Oakley. But he said, "Don't worry, if it's not here in the morning, check with the White Hart." So sure enough, the next morning at Oakley Hall, I asked the owner up there, well, one of the help, the bar managers, "Where's the tandem?" "Well, we can't find it, it has disappeared." So I telephoned the White Hart, and Nick said, "Yes, it's here. Yes, your college mates who stayed here last night, they've been laughing, the fact that it's here this morning. But it's a bit worse for wear." So there's two ways of looking at this, really. Yes, Simon did end up in a ditch. And there's a brake broken, a mudguard came off, and a spoke missing. Well, a spoke came out. But it's still rideable. It's going to get repaired, but the back brake still works. You can still ride it around. The middle saddle's a bit wonky, but things you can live with. But the fact is, hats off to him. He managed to ride all the way back from Oakley to Overton, which is, what, 4 miles?
Yeah.
On a tandem, which is built for two.
Yeah.
It's quite heavy. No lights, but I guess it might have been light anyway this time of year. It might. So let's say it was light.
Yeah, let's say it was light.
5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And maybe he got hit, taken out by a crow or something, or a buzzard.
Probably.
Early morning.
Probably.
I don't know which ditch he ended up in, but he got back safely. That's the main thing. That's all I care about, is that our good assistant manager from this wonderful pub came back safely in one piece.
I should just point out that Simon was absolutely mortified at breaking it and has offered to pay for the damage.
He's a great guy. We all love him, and he's a great friend. So, no, it's more important to me that he was in one piece.
Absolutely.
The bike. The bike's fine. It's a good story as well. Attached to the bike forevermore.
Oh, yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Legendary.
Absolutely.
Overton legend.
Absolutely. Let's go back to television now.
Yeah.
To start wrapping things up here, what do you think makes a great television presenter?
Right. I suppose the ideal television presenter is be yourself. You know, don't. I think some people think that at first, I probably did at first, got put on an act. I used to go over every mistake that I've made and listen back and go, and agonise over it. No, just be yourself. Pretend, well, imagine you're speaking like we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're natural, just natural speaking down the pub, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like you do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
you're telling stories in my case, sport, is if I've just come in, you've not had your phone on, not had your iPad on.
No.
You don't know anything about Saints' result, how they played. I'm just coming and say, do you know what, Rob? They were fantastic tonight, but they're so unlucky. And that you're off telling the story. So be yourself. Don't worry about making fluffs or making mistakes. Don't overthink it. If you're going to read something that's written, write it again in your own words, your own language, because we all say things in different ways. Try and be conversational. The best way to get experience is through fantastic podcasts or a newspaper. Newspapers like you've got around here, the Basingstoke Observer, which Audrey and Laura run. I always call Audrey, she's called Laura, really. She runs great places like that where you get to know how to get local stories, you get used to writing in a journalistic way. Be yourself, be confident, believe in yourself. You're going to get loads of knocks, so you probably wouldn't do that well if you were sensitive about comments that people make. You know, I got told my face was too small, that I look a bit like a fetus sometimes.
An oompa loompa. Oh, my word.
An oompa loompa. Well, my hair's short, that is.
Yeah.
Because it puts weight on you as well.
Yeah.
And so people can be unkind. You've got to just let that go off you.
Absolutely.
Off your back. And editors will say, they were told, well, you haven't got a face for TV, it's too small, your features are too small.
Mm.
But you just ignore that. Believe in yourself, hard work, you know, initially doing it for just the enthusiasm of no money, you just keep going like that, keep going like that, keep going like that. Being yourself, willing to listen, willing to learn. And just try and find the niche, try and find an area to present in that you're interested in, so the passion can come through, rather than just trying to present something that's just reading.
Absolutely.
Because I think it's the passion, being yourself, that's the thing.
Some great tips there.
Yeah.
Mike, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being a guest on the TV Booth podcast.
Oh, it's been an honour, Rob. I think it's a fantastic thing that you do, and it's going to get big.
Absolutely.
I hope so.
All the best. Thank you very much.
Fantastic.
A big thank you to Mike Bushell for giving up his free time to chat with me on the podcast. A big thank you as well to Nick, Kira and the rest of the team at the White Hart in Overton, Hampshire. A fantastic pub. They looked after us really, really well. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of the TV Booth podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. My next guest is the legend, or should that be legend? No, legend. Yes, legend. That is Greg Scott. I'm really looking forward to that one in July. I hope you are too. Don't forget you can download the podcast at tvboothpodcast.co.uk where you'll find all the information you need about the show. But until the next time, thanks for listening. I'm off to go and play noughts and crosses with the test card girl. I'm Rob Francis. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.
The TV Booth podcast is hosted by Rob Francis. Copyright 2019. Because you always need one of those.